Yeah, good morning. They called the Senate Committee, Finance Committee meeting to order. It's 9 o'clock. You senators all cell phones. May 1st today, 2023. I'm joined by Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, and Senator Keel will be back shortly. We have one bill on our schedule today. That's Senate Bill 114 by the Rules Committee. I want to welcome Senator Keel this morning. So before we get started, Senator Walikowski, would you kind of give us an encapsulated introduction to the bill, where it's at today, and what do you see happening? Senator Walikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Walikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage. The bill has changed pretty significantly. It's gone from over 40 pages to around six. And that was predominantly because the provision regarding ring fencing was eliminated. So now there are two main provisions that are left. The first is regarding S-corporations and treating S-corporations with a qualified taxable income that over $4 million per year that I'm going to say this correctly, income that comes from the production of oil and gas as effectively taxing them at the same rate as C corporations are taxed. I met with the Department of Revenue last week. They had some minor changes that they're going to recommend today that I think are probably should be incorporated just to get to what the intent is. The second provision is dealing with the deductible oil tax credits, which are currently a sliding scale that up to $8. This would lower that scale down to $5 and then cap the amount of those credits to the money that is invested by a company in a particular unit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Walikowski. As we talked about, we heard this bill initially on March 12th, there was a committee substitute introduced on April. The bill was first heard on April 12th. A committee substitute was introduced on April 27th. This morning we have invited testimony. So thank you very much, Senator Walikowski. First up is the Department of Revenue. Fidel Lamani, the Deputy Commissioner, and Dan Stickle, please come on up to the table, identify yourself, and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fidel Lamani, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. With me today, we have our Chief Economist for Department of Revenue, Dan Stickle. Also online, we have our Tax Director, Colleen Glover, as well as our Deputy Director of Tax, Brandon Spanos. Our presentation today, Mr. Chair, is based on the requested information from the bill sponsor, which focuses on three key areas. Number one is to provide an update on the fiscal note of the CS, show what the government takes is analysis that's both for the current tax structure as well as SB 114, and provide a retrospective view and a prospective view for a 10-year timeline. Number three, requested that the department confirm whether the tax division has adequate information based on what is currently submitted by the taxpayers to apply the credit limit in use section AS4355024K, which is the same in both versions of the bill. And the answer to that question is yes. One item that we haven't put in our presentation at the request of the sponsor was the life cycle modeling, similar to the Willow Project analysis that included for both the current bill as well as the CS for 114, to providing the net present value and the internal rate of return on the new field development. Considering the timeline that we have allotted today and the complexity and the length of that in and of itself. We have excluded that from this presentation, and we're happy to come before the committee for a later time to provide a presentation on that on a standalone basis. Slide 3, Mr. Chair, provides our presentation overview, which will do a brief history of the corporate income tax as well as the production tax. We'll do some highlights of SB 114 legislation. We'll give you an updated fiscal note summary of the distribution of profits, the effective tax rate, and the order of operations. Looking at the oil and gas corporate income tax history, in 1959, Alaska adopted the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, also known as UDIPTA, which was drafted and approved by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in an attempt to bring uniformity to stack state tax codes. Later in 1970, Alaska adopted the multi-state tax component, also known as MTC, which was a restatement of UDIPTA with some non-major changes. The MTC was codified under AS 43-19.010. Later in 1975, the state adopted the IRC codes by reference, which means that the state adopts any changes to the IRC as they take place. The IRC's provisions have full force and effect unless expected or to modified by other provisions of 43.20. And then later in 1980, the state repealed the individual income tax and retained the S-Corp exemptions. And then in 1981, the state adopted the current oil and gas apportionment factor on the worldwide income, which provided for separate accounting. Looking at the current fiscal regime, generally Alaska follows the Internal Revenue Code when determining an entity's taxable status. This includes many different types of businesses, entities including not only C corporations, S corps, limited liability companies with at least two members, single members LLC that are treated for income tax purposes as disregarded entities, partnerships, and also sole proprietorships. Mr. Chair, it's important to note that Alaska adopts a flow of federal provisions that exempt S corporations from tax. Federally, S corporations are treated as partnerships, and S-Corporation shareholders report their proportionate share of the corporation's earning on their individual income tax return. Alaska treats LLCs as partnerships or sole proprietorship if they file such federally, and these entities are exempt. Therefore, really, the Alaska corporate income tax only applies to C-Corporations. Looking at the oil and gas production tax history, prior to 2006, the production tax system was using the economic limit factor. And then in 2006, the petroleum production tax, the PPT, was established, new tax rates for oil and gas production. And then in 2007, we had the Alaska Clear and Equitable Share, also known as ACES, that provided many amendments, including the addition of the progressivity tax. And then more recently was the More Alaska Production Tax, also known as SB 21, which we'll get into here in a moment. And then also HB 247 was adopted in 2016. And HB 111 in 2017. So both of these legislations changed the tax credit, and HB 247 added the gross value production or reduction, and the HB 111 added the carry forward annual losses. Looking at slide 8, under the current fiscal regime, under SB 21, the objective behind SB 21 was to enhance the competitive investment climate, be able to stabilize production of oil and gas in Alaska, and incentivize North Slope development. There are a few key take areas for SB 21. One is that the production tax rate is set at 35% of production tax value. Also, it sets the minimum tax floor at 4%, and then it also provides for a sliding scale credit between $0 and $8 per taxable barrel.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding SB 21 and its goals, the state has been working under this particular bill for 10 years now. Do you have an evaluation of, have those goals been met?
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hoffman, can you specify in terms of what those goals have been?
Those three from, that you list here.
From the state's perspective?
Yes, the three that you list under goals on page 8, the three bullet points.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickel, Chief Economist, speaking to the goals here on slide 8. Enhance global competitiveness. Obviously, SB 21 overall was a tax reduction to the industry, so it definitely enhanced our competitiveness, and you've seen companies testify to that. Incentivize North Slope development. We have seen some new developments proceed, and I would really defer that one to the industry in particular as to whether SB 21 has acted as a overall incentive to the investments that we have made, that have been made. Stabilized production, that has definitely been something that we have seen since SB 21 passed. We've been around that 500,000 barrel per day mark in production, and that's been quite an accomplishment.
All of Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. I think, though, having been here 10 years ago, that one of the goals was try to fill the pipeline to at least half full, being about a million barrels a day. Was that one of the goals?
Mr. Stickel?
Co-Chair Hoffman, there was an aspirational goal that was laid out by the administration at the time of a million barrels per day. I would view that as aspirational. Obviously, we have not reached a million barrels per day. There's a variety of reasons for that. Some of the restrictions that have been put in place by the federal government on offshore drilling, drilling in ANWR, some of those restrictions have been part of the story there. There are several developments proceeding that have the opportunity to potentially increase production from where we're at today.
Well, I think that speaking from the legislature standpoint, when there was a promise of putting 100 million barrels of oil into the pipeline, and having that happen caught everybody's attention, and so far that goal hasn't been realized. What could the state have done in order to increase that flow?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I think that's probably a topic for a broader conversation and beyond what we're ready to talk about today.
Senator Bishop.
Oh, I'd just like to comment on that. We at this table and the administration and industry, we can all strive to get a million barrels in the day, but we have no control over the lawsuits that come by the opposition. And, you know, a NEPA process on a good day is 10 years, even if it doesn't get a challenge. So I think we need to go in with our eyes wide open when we're looking at lofty goals of increasing a million barrels a day of production. And thanks to your Senator Hoffman's leadership back in D.C., we've, I think, helped crack the loggerheads on Willow.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickel, my recollection is that the prediction was a million barrels a day from state land. That I think, when pressed, was what the administration at the time said. But I guess just to loop back to the co-chairman's initial question on this slide about the three goals there, I'm particularly keen to know what the historical analysis is, because we had folks from the administration by the end of the SB 21 process saying it's going to get us there. And we had someone from one of the major oil producers sit right between where the two of you are on, I think it was March the 17th, and say SB 21 is not a material change. It won't get you any of the results you want. So I was confused. What does history show us?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair, and we do have another slide deck that we'd be happy to bring before the committee as a separate presentation if there is a desire to take a deeper dive into this question of what was hoped for with the change to SB 21 versus what actually did happen. What we know is there's been numerous things that have happened since SB 21 was passed. One is production did stabilize. One is there was a pretty significant decrease in oil price that reduced investment around the world. And so disentangling the tax regime from the changes in oil price, then we had a pandemic that changed things, and different federal government actions. It's very complex to disentangle all of those different moving pieces. But in the essence of time, I think we'd be happy to bring that to the committee at a future hearing.
Is that okay with you, Senator Keel, having me come at a different time when bring this other slide deck? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it'd be nice when you do that to refresh us on the presentations that were given on production previous to that piece of legislation being enacted, SB 21, and the forecasted long-term tail of production going out several decades, and then compare it to what the actual results have been since then. My expectation, they're going to be fairly close. Now, how much marginal benefit the piece of legislation's had, along with going in and having a smaller player come in with one third, I think could be argued or shown that was probably beneficial to some degree. But I think it's going to be interesting to see if you could parse out the major economic changes that has happened since that time. That might be kind of difficult. But it shouldn't be too difficult to look back at the previous presentations that we had that went out several decades. Because the production today, I think, was fairly well predicted 13 years ago.
Thank you, Senator. Close, anyway. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. LaMonte, continue on, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going on to slide 10 is the proposed legislation, SB 114. Primarily impacts the corporate income tax as well as the production tax, specifically the sliding scale per barrel tax credit. And the bill is retroactive to January 1st, 2023. Under the proposed legislations for the corporate income tax, the oil and gas pass-through entities will, with a qualified taxable income of over $4 million at a rate of 9.4%, will be taxed.
Just a question on that.
Before you go on, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that, Mr. LaMonte, I didn't recheck the bill. It just occurred to me when I saw this and thought about slide 6. Does the bill as written apportion that income as oil and gas income or as other corporate income tax, worldwide or water's edge?
Mr. LaMonte.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, oil and gas.
Thank you.
Mr. LaMonte, as we go on to the next, before we go on to the next slide, it's my understanding that the you have asked for an amendment to clarify the corporate income or corporate tax changes that were out there so that Alaska could get its share. You want to comment on that?
Certainly, Senator Olson. We met with the bill sponsor last week on Friday and provided some our viewpoints on areas of the bill where it required the possibility of some amendments. It was to our understanding that the bill sponsor was going to work with the staff and the legislative legal to be able to incorporate those changes. We haven't seen a draft of what that language would look like, but it is our understanding that those are being worked on as we speak.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead.
Looking at slide 12, this slide shows the prospective impacts for the 10 years out. Currently, we have 28 non-C-Corp oil and gas entities doing business in Alaska. And so since we don't have uncertain data, we're limited data on the revenue impacts. The fiscal note was based on the estimates on the analysis using the share of oil and gas production attributable to pass-through entities, and then scaling up the corporate income tax forecast to assume the pass-through entities would pay corporate income tax at a similar rate as a C corporation based on production.
As you look at this particular slide, FY24 catches your attention because it's at 190. I realize that's an estimate, but what do you think the reason for that is that it's so high? Is that because it has an effective date of 18 months?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's because of the retroactive aspect.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions on by members of the committee on this slide? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Does the department have, or the administration have a position on that date? Retroactivity.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we did when we had the discussion with the bill sponsor, and we provided our feedback in terms of what that would look like or the impacts that it could have. And so the department will wait until we see some proposed language from the bill sponsor to see what that will look like through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So they have not definitely ruled it out that they would be against it. Is that correct?
From the conversations through the chair, what we've got is that they were entertaining those amendments.
Senator Stedman.
Well, this is a follow-up to Senator Hoffman. So does the department support the bill or support the concept of the bill or pieces of parts of the bill? Or
Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stedman, the department does not have a position on the bill. We were just providing the factual information that was requested by the bill sponsor. What we can say is that this may have immediate revenue impacts to the state. However, it could have long-term impacts, negative impacts to the state, based on the decisions that oil companies will make as it pertains to their future investment outlook. Generally, anytime that they have to make additional tax liability payments, it's generally shifting that resource from somewhere else. And so there could be a possibility of some impacts there that we're not necessarily privy to that information with industry.
Sure. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk about on the slide 12 here, some of the fiscal note impact, estimated impacts of why we have such a steep decline in outgoing years?
Deputy Commissioner Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilson, I'll defer that to our chief economist.
Mr. Stickle.
Chair, Dan Stickle for the record. Looking at slide 12, yeah, the fiscal estimated fiscal impacts of extending the oil and gas corporate tax to the non-C corporations does show a decline over time, and there's two primary reasons for that. One is that our oil price forecast shows some backwardation, so the oil price is expected to be decreasing over time as we get into the longer term of the forecast, looking at the futures market until we get to about fiscal year 2030. The other piece is that the share of production from the non-C corporations is expected to decrease over time. So a lot of the additional production that we're seeing coming on in the forecast are being is that that's coming from more of the C corporations. So the potential additional tax base is going down for those two reasons.
Follow up, Senator Wilson. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lamani, you, I think Senator Wilikowski said there were two provisions, and I think he responded to the second provision where you haven't taken a position. But have you? Has the administration taken a position on the S corporations to C corporations?
Mr. Lamani.
To level the playing field among the industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hoffman, no, the department does not have a position on the distinguishment between the C Corp and the S Corp at this time.
Follow up, Senator Hoffman. Go ahead, Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving to slide 13, this shows the tax brackets for the qualifying entities. You will find on the left-hand side there a chart summarizing the existing tax brackets. And then on the right-hand side is what the proposed legislation provide, which is the taxable income, $4 million or greater, will provide for a 9.4% taxable income.
Sir Steven.
I'm just kind of puzzled back to Senator Hoffman's question. Didn't the previous revenue commissioner come before the committee and advocate a subchapter S change a year ago and advocated it from the department's perspective? So has there been a change I know we've gone through an election, so it's technically a different administration, but it's all the same people. Is there a directional change from the department, or did the previous revenue commissioner misspeak? Or
Mr. Lamani, are you free to go ahead and voice your opinion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Steadman, again, just to reiterate, we don't have a position on this at this moment. The idea was for us to provide the facts as requested by the bill sponsor. Department of Revenue was never asked by this committee to do a comprehensive assessment on SB 114. And so would happy to provide additional information as it pertains to the entirety of the bill. For the purposes of this hearing, we've only provided what we've been asked by the bill sponsor.
Sure. Senator Merrick. I'm sorry, do you have a follow-up, Senator?
Yes, just a quick follow-up. I think then, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be nice to invite him back at some point to focus in on the bill 114 that's in front of us in detail as amended, because I think it's we're on our second CS, so just so it's clear that I think that would be helpful.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Good morning. Do we have any idea how many companies fit into each of these categories?
Mr. Lamani.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, not right off top of our head, but I'm pretty sure that we can get that number in terms of what those brackets are.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Following along with Senator Stubman's last comment, if and when we get to do that deeper dive, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to see the modeling done on SB 21 as it originally passed the Senate. And so we can have a side-by-side comparison to really see the true impacts.
So you're talking about having revenue come back before us with modeling that's done, or somebody else?
Revenue, if that's the way that I hear the table going on.
Is that a possibility, Mr. Commissioner Lamont?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. No further questions. Go on with the set. Go on with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This next slide is the under the proposed legislation for the production tax credit. It would change the per barrel tax credit, the sliding scale per credits only, and it would also limit the per barrel tax credit to the amount of the qualified capital expenditure. Slide number 15, this slide here represents all of the per barrel tax credits historically and for forecast usage under the current tax regime for fiscal year 2014, the per barrel tax credit was in effect only for 6 months of the fiscal year, and the per barrel tax credits have been aggregated due to the taxpayer confidentiality. Slide 16 is the sliding scale per barrel tax credits. On the left-hand side is what the current statutes provide, and on the right-hand side is what the proposed legislation under 114. Really, the key takeaway is that the per barrel tax credit is reduced by $3 for each of those categories, and it caps at $120 for the gross value point of production compared to the $150 under the current law. Slide number 17, we were asked to show what the gross net crossover point before and after the proposed legislation of SB 114. This is based on the 2023 spring revenue forecast and is aggregated for R North Slope for the fiscal year 2024 forecast. The crossover point in which the aggregation production tax of revenue exceeds the gross minimum tax floor, and for under the current law, it's $53 per barrel, and then under the proposed legislation, the crossover is at $40 a barrel. While the decrease is $13 and the minimum floor has remained unchanged, all that means is that the floor gets exceeded a lot sooner. With that, Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions for me, I will turn the rest of the presentation to Mr. Stickle to go over the fiscal note, the distribution of profits, the effective tax rate, and also the order of operations.
Mr. Stickle.
Sure, thank you. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. So as we get into the fiscal note, we have our disclaimer slide on slide 19. So we are taking one of the most complex fiscal systems in the world, making some simplifying assumptions for presentation purposes. And we're actually, with the legislation before you, we're actually adding a layer of complexity on top of what is already a very complex tax system. And just a reminder that I'm an economist, not an auditor, so anything I say is not an official tax interpretation. Okay. Slide 20 is the detailed fiscal table for the most recent CS for the bill. What this fiscal table assumes no changes to production or investment. That's consistent with how we've prepared fiscal notes for oil and gas tax legislation in the past. And what we do here is we walk through each of the major provisions of the bill on its own and calculate a fiscal impact relative to the spring 2023 revenue forecast. And then we model all of the provisions together to come up with a total fiscal impact that's highlighted in the yellow there. So the total fiscal impact does not exactly match the sum of the individual provisions, primarily because the two different provisions related to the per taxable barrel credits have some overlap in how they would impact companies. Again, fiscal year 2024 includes the retroactive tax calculation back to January 1st of 2023, so those numbers are looking a little bit higher. Walking through the table, the first line here is the reduction to the scale for the sliding scale per taxable barrel credits. We estimate that reduction alone would increase revenue by $586 million in fiscal year 2024, $332 million in fiscal year 2025, and then decreasing to $240 million by fiscal year 2033. And those lower amounts later years are largely a function of the lower price and companies having a little bit less headroom above the minimum tax floor. So to the extent that credits are limited by the minimum tax floor, there's just less impact of reducing those credits. The second line is the impact of limiting per taxable barrel credits to the amount of capital expenditures made in the year. We have modeled this as applying on a unit level, and the impact of that limitation would be $647 million in fiscal year 2024 and $332 million in fiscal year 2025, and then again decreasing a little bit in the later years. This particular line of the revenue estimate has a high degree of uncertainty around it, because there's actually a very strong incentive for companies to increase their investments if they're in that situation where their capital expenditure or their credits are limited by capital expenditures. They can actually get a dollar for dollar benefit then by increasing those capital expenditures. It would be reasonable to expect that the fiscal impact of this provision would be smaller than what's shown on the fiscal note. Of course, the extent to which companies avail themselves of that is challenging to estimate. The third line here is what we showed earlier in the presentation, which is the impact of applying that corporate income tax at the 9.4% rate on income over $4 million to the non-C corporations. And then the total fiscal impact, we're estimating around $1.1 billion in fiscal year 2024, again, including the retroactive payments of about $356 million, and then a $610 million impact in fiscal year 2025, decreasing to $391 million by fiscal year 2033. Slide 21 is a chart that shows the numbers from that fiscal note table for the 10-year forecast at a range of prices. These numbers exclude the retroactive payment for the January through June of 2023 period. At the forecast price, we see the highest impact in fiscal years 24 through 27. That's because that's where we have the little bit higher price and expect companies to have a little bit more headroom above the minimum tax for the reduction in credits to have an impact. At the lower prices of $20 and $40 per barrel, fairly small impacts. The $60 per barrel is interesting. You see decreasing impacts over time at the $60 per barrel. That has to do with a combination of expectations that costs, company spending will increase over time, as well as declining production from the major taxpayers. A lot of that, some of that new production that is keeping overall production fairly steady, some of that's coming from new taxpayers. And then at the $80 per barrel, you see an interesting drop off in the impact in fiscal year 29 and 2030. That's the similar situation there where you have increasing costs and decreasing production from major taxpayers. So you have a little bit less headroom above the minimum tax for the credit value when you're reducing the value of those credits, a little bit less headroom there for that to impact. And then in the early years, you're seeing the full. So in the earlier years, you're seeing the full $3 per barrel cut of the credit, and then in the later years, the effective reduction in the credit is a little less than that $3 per barrel.
Mr. Stickle, Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, can we revert to the previous slide for a moment and look at, can you provide me and maybe the committee with the number of impacts going back to the sale to Hillcorp, how much money would we have received during that time frame? Yeah, I know you don't have that today, but I think it would be interesting to see that number for the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lamani, I'm sorry. Brief at ease. Back to order. Mr. Deputy Commissioner Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I was going to reiterate is that we're already working on a similar request that's been brought to the Department of Revenue from this committee. It only focuses on the Prudhoe Bay satellite fields, does not necessarily entail the entire North Slope.
Yes, thanks.
Senator Merrick has a question.
Thank you, Chair Olson. This is, I'm showing that we are on draft version R, and your presentation is on version U. I just want to know if there's any significant difference.
Mr. Lamani. You got a brief at ease? Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Merrick, yes, the proposed version of the bill that is stated right now, the modeling that we're presenting here does in fact incorporate those changes.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no further questions, go ahead with your presentation.
Again, Dan Stickle for the record. So I believe we'd finished the fiscal note discussion and we're ready to move on.
Senator Stedman.
Well, when he's done with the slide, I have a question on 21, please.
Are you done with the slide, Mr. Stickle?
I'm ready for questions, Mr.
Okay.
I'd just like Mr. Stickle to remind us how the department integrated Willow into this, into their modeling.
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman. So the Willow field is incorporated into the spring 2023 forecast on a risked basis. So we include a portion, but not all, of the potential production and costs from that field. And this slide is based on the forecast. So the risked production and costs from Willow are incorporated into this analysis.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just a quick one on that. And I think we'll probably have some more questions on our structure here as we go forward with the price changes. But if you added in all the cost and the revenue, is the net going to go up or down or stay about the same as these charts reflect?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman. So if you added in all of the costs and all of the revenue from Willow, you would have a lower production tax value until production comes online. So that would be through about fiscal year 2028. And then you'd have a higher overall value in the later years. As to exactly how those two net out, that would be probably something to get back to the committee on.
Senator Stedman, follow up. Beth, go ahead with your presentation, Mr. Lamani.
Sure. So the next set of slides at the request of the committee was looking at the distribution of profits. You'll also hear this called the distribution of cash flow or the government take analysis. Slide 23 lays out some of the key assumptions here. So for this particular analysis, we are showing how the profit is shared for a typical barrel of oil production. And for that typical barrel, we're looking at production on state land with a 12.5% royalty that is not subject to the gross value reduction. So this is going to be a lot of your production from fields like Prudhoe Bay, Kuparik, some of the other legacy fields. We have some rules of thumb that we apply for property tax and corporate income tax assumptions. And we're actually going to show this with and without state corporate income tax under current law to acknowledge that some of the companies are subject to the tax and some are not. As we go through this, obviously, the economics for any individual company or field will vary, so this is just an illustration overall. Slide 24, the first chart shows the distribution of profits for the typical barrel of oil for fiscal year 2024. Out of the $73 per barrel sales price that we're forecasting, $40.13 remains after all costs. Those are the lease expenditures and the transportation costs are deducted. The producer would keep $20.15 or 50% of the profits, and state municipal governments would get $14.63 or 36% of profits, and the federal government through the federal corporate tax would get $5.36 or 13% of profit. The middle barrel shows what this would look like for a company that is not subject to the state corporate income tax. In that situation, the overall government take would drop to 48%. The producer would keep 52% of the profit. And under committee substitute for Senate Bill 114 on the right, it is a tax increase. And almost all companies then would be subject to corporate income tax, whether through the existing C corps or the expansion to the additional companies. With Senate Bill 114, state and municipal governments would keep 43%, and the producer would keep 45%. So overall government take would increase from 48 to 50% up to 55%.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, just for the folks at home, maybe the first two barrels on the left, the 9.4% corporate income tax rate makes about a 2% difference in the take, when on the previous slide you said 4% was the effective tax rate. Can you just walk through how all those pieces come together to this?
Sure, Senator Keel through the chair. So the state corporate income tax applies to worldwide income as apportioned to Alaska based on Alaska's share of production, property, and sales and tariffs. Generally, the Alaska tends to be slightly more profitable than the rest of the world. So the effective tax rate, when you look at tax that comes, state corporate income tax that's actually paid to the state compared to profit in the state, that effective rate is where we get the 4.25% rule of thumb. So it is a little bit less than if you just took the 9.4% through a separate accounting methodology.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then the next step would be that only leads to a 2% shift in that state take line. Can you walk through that piece too?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair, and this goes back to the overall order of operations of the fiscal system. So you have your overall profit, and when we're looking at that, we're looking at the total cash flow available for distribution. Royalty comes off the top of that. So does property tax. So does state production tax. And so the state corporate income tax is only applying to that remaining share of profit after subtracting out the royalty, production tax, and property tax. And so it's that remaining value that we're applying the 4.25% effective tax rate to.
Thank you. That's helpful. Okay.
Mr. Stickle, I guess as I look at this, I see that on the left side, you've got where state income, or you've got corporate income tax is being paid at 50%. But it looks like under Senate Bill 114, you go down to 48% for those companies that aren't paying state income tax. Is that, am I reading this wrong, or is that really the truth?
Mr. Chairman, so the left left and the middle barrel are both based on current law. The only difference between those two barrels is whether the company is subject to state corporate income tax. So in the left barrel, for a company that is subject to state corporate income tax, we expect that state and municipal governments would receive 36% of total profits. And then for a company not subject to the state corporate tax, we estimate that that number would be 34% of total profits. And then on the right-hand barrel is under the Senate Bill 114, we estimate that state municipal governments would receive 43% of total profits. And that's a combination of the fact that all companies would be subject to corporate income tax, as well as the tax increase in the production tax.
Okay. Okay, go ahead and continue with the presentation.
So slide 25 shows the share of cash flows at a range of prices. So these are, we basically took the three barrels from slide 24 and then broke them out into three of these charts at a range of prices. So this first chart is for a company that is subject to state corporate income tax. At $40 per barrel, there's very little profit to go around, and the state and municipal governments take almost all of that profit between royalty, minimum tax floor for production tax, and then the property tax. The lowest level of government take is around 50%, and that occurs when we're in the $60 to $80 per barrel price range, which just happens to be the price range that we're forecasting for the next several years. Once you get above the $80 per barrel price range, government take starts to increase again, since the state has the progressive elements in the production tax. Slide 26 is a very similar slide, but for a company not subject to state corporate income tax. So you'll see that the state and municipal share is a little lower across the board, and then the producer and federal shares are a little bit higher across the board compared to the previous slide. And then slide 27 shows that distribution of cash flows at a range of prices with Senate Bill 114. Once again, the highest share to the company and the lowest share of government take occurs when prices are in that $60 to $80 per barrel range, with higher government take once you go below the $60 due to the gross tax floor and other elements that are fixed or based on gross value, and then also that government share increases once you go above $80 per barrel, given the progressive elements of the tax system. Senate Bill 114 is a tax increase at most prices, so that lowest level of government take is more like 55% under Senate Bill 114 versus 50% under current law.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, do you have any comparison to some of our, neighboring states that are also oil and gas producers on a similar slide of sort of their state municipal share versus the federal share versus the producer share?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, not at the ready, we don't.
Okay. Would that be, Mr. Chair?
Follow-ups?
Would that be able something that the department might be able to provide to the committee to see where we're sort of benchmarking this at with some of our competitor states?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, so we do not currently have a tax consultant, which is usually where we go to that. We could provide some high-level illustrations, though.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, go ahead and continue.
So slide 28 shows a history of estimated government take since fiscal year 2007. This was the first full year of the switch to the net profits tax, where we have solid information about company spending. And then we show that up through fiscal year 2022, and then a 10-year forecast, both under current law and under Senate Bill 114. Again, this is based on our aggregate analysis for a typical barrel of production in each fiscal year, and we assume that the company is subject to state corporate income tax. What we see here is that government take was consistently in that 60 to 70% range for most of the years through fiscal year 17. The one exception was in fiscal year 2016, where there was a very high level of government take. That was because of the very low oil prices in fiscal year 2016. There just was not much profit to go around in fiscal year 16, and the state and municipal governments took most of it due to royalties, minimum tax, and property tax.
What effect did Senate Bill 21 have on that?
Mr. Chairman, you can see here that Senate Bill 21 actually had a fairly modest impact on overall government take. We were in that 60 to 70% range prior to Senate Bill 21 passing, which took effect in fiscal year 2014, and then maybe slightly lower government take following Senate Bill 21, but really fairly consistent. The big story on this slide was the federal corporate income tax cuts that took effect in 2018. The federal marginal corporate tax rate went from 35% to 21%, and that took effect again in 2018. And you see that there was really a regime change in terms of government take, where we went from typically in that mid-60s range to now we've been in the 50 to 55% range since those tax cuts took place. That was a huge change for economics for any investments in the United States, including oil and gas on the North Slope. Under current law, we would expect total government take to be in that around 50% over the rest of the 10-year forecast. Under Senate Bill 114, we'd expect that to be in the closer to 55% range going forward.
Okay. Thank you. Continue. Oh, sorry, statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a, I guess reflection back when we did 21, Senate Bill 21, we set the rate at 35%, which was the federal rate, tax rate, which some of us argued at the time had absolutely nothing to do with our severance tax. It was a corporate income tax issue rate. And then the feds changed it to 21%, leaving us with a 35% imbalance. Some of us have always thought that was one of the destabilizing mechanisms embedded in the system. So it's just something to reflect back on, because I still don't know where that 35% came from, other than it was a corporate tax rate, which is not a severance tax, it's a corporate income tax. So that's an issue that we, I guess, are left with. Mr. Sticker, go ahead. I'd like to also ask the presenter, maybe future presenters, the 35% allows for quicker deductions of expenditures against offsets against future our current revenue, which we have to have. You have to be able to deduct your expenditures. But under the current structure now, the deduction rate is 35%, where the corporate rate is 21%. So it just doesn't, they're just that little anomaly. And I do recognize that if we ever look at or change that 35% deduction issue based tax rate, it's going to have an impact on the cash flow timing negatively to the industry. So it's not as easy as just change the rate and everything goes back into equilibrium.
Thank you, Senator Simon. Go ahead and put your stick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the next set of slides look at effective tax rates. When we talk about effective tax rates, we're looking at effective tax rates on net profit. So it's that same production tax value as we're looking at production tax paid as a share of production tax value. This chart on slide 30 looks at that effective tax rate for production not eligible for the gross value reduction. This is for under current law and Senate Bill 114. Again, we're looking at typical aggregate production and for fiscal year 2024. So under current law, the effective tax rates are the highest at lower prices due to the gross minimum tax floor. Those effective tax rates exceed 50% when you're at $40 per barrel, and then quickly go to over 100% once you go below $40 per barrel. The lowest effective tax rates are at around $70 per barrel at around 8% effective tax rate. And that's when companies have more profit, but they're able to use per taxable barrel credits to reduce their tax liability down to the minimum tax floor. Once you get above $70 per barrel, the effective tax rates start to increase. That's when companies are lifting off that minimum floor and paying higher than the minimum floor. Eventually, the 35% statutory tax rate applies when the sliding scale credits completely phase out, and that happens at around $160 per barrel in the fiscal 24 modeling. Under Senate Bill 114, the effective tax rates are higher only when companies are paying above the minimum tax floor. So there's no changes made to the minimum floor. The lowest effective tax rate would now be around 10% at a price a little under $60 per barrel, and again would reach that statutory 35% rate when the sliding scale credits phase out, which would now be around $130 per barrel under Senate Bill 114.
Go ahead and continue.
Slide 31 is a similar slide showing the effective tax rates for production that would be eligible for the gross value reduction. As a standalone with no other fields or interactions, there would not be an impact on gross value reduction eligible production. This assumes that a company can use that flat $5 per taxable barrel credit to eliminate all tax until they get to the low $60 per range. This assumes that the company has sufficient capital expenditures that they're able to realize that full $5 per barrel tax credit. If they did not have sufficient capital expenditures, then 114 would be a tax increase for GBR eligible production.
Senator Stidman.
Mr. Stickle, could you please remind the committee Willow and Pica, the new, two new fields, where they would fall on these two slides? Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Senator, Co-Chair Stedman through the chair. So Willow and Pica being new developments would likely be eligible for the gross value reduction provisions. So they would fall under this second category for their initial period of production. After either 3 years or 7 years, depending on the oil price, they would then graduate to being non-gross value reduction eligible production, and they would fall under the first example.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman. Not go ahead and continue with your presentation.
And the final set of information we were asked to provide was to show how Senate Bill 114 impacts the order of operations for the production tax calculation. So slide 33, as a refresher, this is our overall order of operations that we presented to the committee earlier this session, shows how the production tax is calculated with a focus on North Slope oil taxes. We started with the average oil price forecast for fiscal year 2024 of $73 per barrel and the daily production of 496,000 barrels per day to get to the annual value of $13.3 billion for oil produced on the slope. And we looked at how that worked its way through the production tax calculation. So under current law, there would be $10 billion of gross value, $4.6 billion of deductible lease expenditures, and a production tax value of $5.4 billion. The 35% net rate would generate a tax before credits of $1.85 billion. Companies would be able to apply about $1.1 billion of per taxable barrel credits, and then there would be about $742 million of total production tax paid to the state, and that's our official forecast for fiscal year 2024. What slide 34 shows is how this would look like with Senate Bill 114. So the basic tax calculation is the same. The difference here is on the per taxable barrel credits. So the sliding scale credits would be reduced by $556 million, or $566 million to $553 million, similar numbers there. But that $566 million reduction would represent a 76% tax increase in fiscal year 2024.
So, Mr. Stickle, as you look at the 76% tax increase that's going on there, that's the actual percentage that's being taken by the government during that period of time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, so to look at the actual percentage of profit that's taken by the industry, that's where we would go back to those government take slides, mm-hmm. Where the government take went from 48% to 50% to about 55%. The $566 million, that represents the additional production tax revenue component of that in dollar terms.
Okay. But as far as what the state would get, isn't it significantly lower than that? Than the $566 million?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. I'll get back with you later. Go ahead and go on. We're starting to run out of time.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
I mean, I'm interested in the answer to that. What's the – this is one of several forms of tax, right? So what's the delta in government take as a percentage?
Mr. Stickle.
Senator Keel, through the chair. So the delta in overall government take, that's what we were looking at earlier, where it would be about a 5 to 7% increase in government take.
Thank you.
And this is the largest piece of that. The other piece of it is the corporate income tax extending to the non-C corporations.
Okay, go ahead.
So we have several additional slides in the appendix that look at the impact of changes in lease expenditures and what would happen if you had a company that had lower capital expenditures than average and was subject to those limitations in the bill where capital expenditure or tax credits are limited to the amount of capital spending. We'd be happy to go through any of those in detail if the committee would like. But this slide 35 has some of the general conclusions from that analysis. So currently, if a company is above the minimum tax floor, they get a immediate 35% production tax benefit for any additional investments they make to the state. Senate Bill 114 keeps that same overall system, but then adds that requirement that you have to have sufficient capital expenditures to realize your per taxable barrel credits. For a company that's above the minimum tax floor, but they're not spending enough capital expenditures to get the full value of their credits, there's actually a what we call a gold plating opportunity. And that's where each additional dollar of investment would earn the company $1.35. So they'd get the dollar for dollar increase in their tax credits by making those additional expenditures plus the normal 35% tax deduction. And we just point out that that adds a layer of complexity and uncertainty to the tax system and the fiscal impact estimates. And as we've seen with prior tax changes, sometimes there's unintended consequences. And just pointed that out in the appendix slides. And again, would be happy to go into those in more detail if that's helpful to the committee. Otherwise, we can wrap up and take any questions.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Department of Revenue? The Senator Sedman.
Can we go back to slide 28, please? So that delta change, Mr. Stickle, are you sure that or fairly confident that most of that delta change, other than the spike with the collapse of oil prices, forget about that issue, is due to the corporate income tax change from 35 to 21% and then having no changes on the state side? Is that accurate?
Co-chair Stedman, there's obviously lots of moving pieces here that impact the changes in government take. There's changes in operators, changes in investment levels, some pretty significant changes in oil prices. There's changes in production. But the largest, the most significant component in terms of the government, obviously changes in our state fiscal system. The most significant change to the government take analysis was the federal corporate tax change.
Any other questions by members of the committee for Department of Revenue? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next, we have up Kara Moriarty, who's the executive director for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. She has several slides, and she will be introducing her consultant. Ms. Moriarty, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I know I see copies of my presentation on the desk. Is it possible to put it on the screen as well, Mr. Chairman?
Sure. You netties?
Come back on the record, please. We have now have the AOGA presentation up on the screen. If you could maybe introduce yourself for the record real quick, along with your consultant, and then take us through your presentation, then we'll go on into N3 Energies, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Stedman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Kara Moriarty. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. With me today is no stranger to the committee or to this legislature and state policy in general, Rich Ruggiero with N3 Energy, and he will introduce himself more thoroughly during his portion of the presentation. The Alaska Oil and Gas Association is commonly referred to as AOGA. We are the professional trade association representing the majority of explorers, producers, transporters, and refiners of oil and gas in Alaska. Our mission is to advocate for the long-term viability of the industry in the state. Senate Bill 114 is a massive tax increase, and our membership, as you can see depicted by these logos on the screen, the membership is unanimously opposed to this bill. We appreciate the invitation to be part of invited testimony today and for allowing me to share a few thoughts before we turn it over to Mr. Ruggiero. Alaska's oil and gas industry provides jobs, supports local businesses, and contributes more to our economy than any other singular industry in the state. McKinley Research Group concluded in their last economic study of the industry that Alaska's oil and gas industry remains the single most important economic engine in the state. This data was collected right before the COVID pandemic hit, and we are in the process of updating that study, and the results will be completed by the end of August. Increasing taxes results in a higher net cost to the oil and gas companies, meaning they have less money to invest in Alaska. Any change in oil and gas taxes impacts both the North Slope and Cook Inlet. As Mr. Ruggiero is going to explain, the world of oil and gas is dramatically different today than when Senate Bill 21 was passed. Alaska has not been immune to those changes, and you can see it's certainly different in the Cook Inlet today than it was a decade ago and certainly two decades ago. Cook Inlet gas production has been lower than usage since 2019. So any change to Alaska's tax system truly does need to be analyzed both on impacts of our state economy, North Slope, but as well as the Cook Inlet. The Cook Inlet natural gas is by far the lowest cost and most reliable form of energy available to South Central Alaskans. So Senate Bill 114, without any uncertainty, will result in higher energy costs for the majority of Alaskans living in South Central. The Department of Revenue reviewed these principles from Senate Bill 21, which was a decade ago, and these principles currently guide our current state tax policy. We would argue that the system is working as intended, and my last slide will especially highlight why we believe so. I know this chart is a little hard to read. I am not a slide maker pro, not a slide pro. But it has been said that Senate Bill 114 is the same as the version of Senate Bill 21 as it passed the Senate Finance Committee. It's not exactly the same. So what this chart shows you from the left to the right is from ACES, back before we had Senate Bill 21, the red column are the main changes that were made in the Senate Finance version as passed, and to what we have before you today in Senate Bill 114. So just a few components, and I did not include every component, just the ones that I think that are most relative to the argument today. But as you can see, the base tax rate, as originally proposed, was 25% in Senate Bill 21. This committee version bill raised that to 35% for the first 3 to 4 years, and then reduced it back from 35 to 33 effective January 1st, 2017. When the bill was originally introduced, if you look at the per barrel credit or negative progressivity, there were no per barrel deductions in the original version, but when the tax rate increased, the per barrel was put in, and it was a flat $5 across every price. It wasn't a sliding scale that we see today. The other important difference, I believe, is the last column, or the last row, I guess, where credits could be used to reduce the minimum tax below the floor, as it's commonly referred to, where it could pierce the floor. And the Senate Finance version allowed that to happen. The bill moved to the Senate floor, and the tax rate went up to 35% forever, the 33% after January 1st, 2017 went away. But then when the bill went over to the House, that's when we saw the sliding scale introduced. The House Resources version of the bill reduced the tax rate from 35 to 33 and introduced the sliding scale concept. So that's where it was first come about, I guess, in this process. The other major change was the credits, it hardened the floor. So only per barrel credits from new oil, which is not as significant of production as the legacy fields, we were no longer able to pierce the floor, if you will. And so that's why you have that minimum cross at the minimum tax where it becomes effective. So when we look at Senate Bill 114 compared to Senate Bill 21 as passed the Senate Finance Committee, the major differences are the tax rate doesn't go back to the 33% as the Senate Finance Committee suggested back then, and it reduces the per barrel across a variety of prices. It doesn't, it's just not the flat $5 per barrel. And we are not able to pierce the floor. So I just wanted to point out that those are some of the differences. My testimony from 10 years ago on the Senate Finance version, we did not endorse the $5 flat per barrel. We said it was an interesting concept, and I actually went back and read through all that testimony from back then, and my testimony in House Finance is that we were not allowed to testify to the sliding scale. That came after our testimony in House Resources. The testimony in House Finance, we supported the sliding scale at that point. So I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention. Lastly, is Senate Bill 21 working and achieving the principles? And we would argue this that it is. And I know that this is kind of a busy slide. So, but what this shows you is production from 2007 to now and moving forward. The blue line shows actual production during the period of ACES. And then the blue line is actual production after Senate Bill 21. The red line is the last DOR forecast under ACES that showed that production was going to continue to decline at the same level, the trajectory that it was on. This is about a 6 to 8% decline. So Senate Bill 21 passes and production has stabilized. And I think that was the terminology that DOR just used, is that it has stabilized. And in fact, now, because it was a 10-year forecast, so it stopped in 2022, the 2013 forecast. But you can see that the oil and gas production was 137,000 barrels more than it would have been under the last forecast of ACES. What's really interesting to note is when you throw in oil price and the chaos that oil price has had over the last 15 years. So we saw a massive spikes in oil price during the time of ACES, but we had this dramatic production decline. Senate Bill 21 is passed. Then we have a dramatic decrease in oil price, but production leveled out and maintained at this $500,000 level. Then we were hit with the pandemic and we had negative oil price during that time. And then this is the production forecast moving forward from the 2023 spring production forecast. I would just mention there was the million barrels per day brought up, the goal brought up in the DOR's presentation. And I actually looked up the document that the Department of Natural Resources issued in January 25th, 2012, that outlined the ambitious goal of a million barrels a day. The memo outlines from the Department of Natural Resources at the time that million barrels a day could be achieved from increasing production in legacy fields, smaller pools like Ugaruk and Nikaichuk, production from the eastern North Slope, shale and viscous and heavy oil, which we have yet to see the technology develop to accurately or to achieve those goals. But then the remaining portion was on federal land. It was MPRA, Umiat, Liberty, ANWR, OCS, the Chukchi and Beaufort, and that the commercialization of natural gas would lead to additional oil discoveries and production. So I just wanted to point that out since it was brought up during the other hearing. And that concludes my slides, and I'm happy to take any questions before we turn it over to our consultant.
We have some questions by members of the committee. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moriarty, you had stated your membership is opposed to the bill, Senate Bill 114. But I think there are two major provisions in here. One, this bill would level the playing field for producers. The change for the S corporation to a C corporation would basically level the playing field for those for Hillcorp to be in line with the other corporations. I believe many of the people in the state and in this building feel that was a loophole that was never intended until Hillcorp had purchased that asset. So are you saying that you're not supporting leveling the playing field and therefore are opposed to that particular provision?
Ms. Moriarty?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, AOCA is opposed to every portion of the bill as it stands.
Bob, Senator Hoffman.
And not favoring leveling the playing field. They want to support a dual system for tax structure for the majors on the North Slope.
Ms. Moriarty?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the Oil and Gas Association works by unanimous consent, and I would not be able to testify today that we oppose all sections of the bill unless that was true. And so we oppose all portions of the bill.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's why we are the policymakers.
Thank you. Any further? Our Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moriarty, thanks for being here today. I agree there's a lot of chaos in this slide, and there are definitely both positive and negative correlations. And I don't know if the question is better for you or for Mr. Ruggiero, but there is a pretty tight correlation. It's not on your slide. You have plenty of lines on here. But I think just about every major oil province, every basin has roughly developed has the same basic production curve, rapid ramp up, peak production, a steep decline, and a long tail. This turn in the blue line from roughly 05 to 15, doesn't that roughly correlate to that turn from steep decline to a long tail? Could the correlation be geology?
Ms. Moriarty?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I don't think it's all geology because we know that we have a lot of oil and gas remaining on the North Slope. Even today, we believe there's another 2 billion barrels of oil in the legacy fields in itself. And we have added some incremental fields like Ugruk and Nikaichuk and now Greater Moose's Tooth. We have some amazing prospects in Willow and Pikka that can change this. We have seen an actual increase in production in our legacy field of Prudhoe Bay. It's a 45-year-old field. We had more production in 2021 than we had in 2020. We had more production in 2022 than we had in 2021. And the companies, the operator, and the owners, their goal is to continue to keep that stable. That happens with ongoing development in the field. Well workovers, fixing broken wells instead of deciding to not fix them, to try to continue to let them produce. So it didn't have to be on this trajectory that you saw. There was a way to stabilize production and level that off. And so I think that's what, to me, that's what that shows.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As mentioned earlier, you know, we've had presentations on this for years. And I recall, and we've already asked for earlier in the meeting, recall presentations dealing with the legacy fields and the parabolic curve and the long tail and how it was forecasted to be in that range for several decades. In fact, maybe even longer than several decades. And that as the field matures, the bigger firms will go into harvest mode and then eventually sell out to smaller operators. We should have at the time, Mr. Chairman, thought about the smaller operators not being Chapter C. That was our error. But anyway, so all this has been talked about at this table, watching this natural progression. It's going to be interesting to see if we can delineate how much marginal increase in production is derived by price or by Hillcorp's streamlined process. Certainly, it's had a positive effect, and it would be pretty hard not to argue it has been a positive effect. But I think to put exact numbers on it is going to be very difficult. And it looks like most of the projections going forward are for that long flat tail to continue. And maybe we get lucky and the state sees Willow develop and Pikka, and we get a little upswing. So it'll be interesting when we pull those old presentations, because as I recall this presentation, when they were showing us the continual decline, some of us weren't believing that was going to take place. You'd have to sit and do nothing and ignore it and watch the shipwreck versus take corrective action, and we would never do that.
Comment on the comment, Ms. Moriarty?
I can be a Mrs. Senator. I am a Mrs. That's okay. No, I'm fine. I'm unless there are no other questions, I'm happy to have the staff help us switch out the presentations and move on to Mr. Ruggiero.
Let's go ahead and go on with Mr. Ruggiero.
It is a different presentation. So, okay, she's got.
Brief at ease. Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Ruggiero, you've been here a number of times before. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record. Go ahead with your presentation. I know we got a fair amount of slides, and we just got them this morning. So if we have to go on, we have public testimony slated for this afternoon, but we will have you back tomorrow morning if that's okay with you. And Ms. Moriarty, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rich Ruggiero with N3 Energy. And as Senator Stedman said earlier, I've been coming here and working with various entities since 2006 on oil and gas taxation. You'd think I'd learned my lesson by now, and I'd be fully enjoying my retirement, but it's still something that intrigues me. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer Senator Keel's question.
Please do.
Before I get started. I'm going to give you an answer from a 100,000-foot view instead of the detail. And conventional reservoirs where I've worked, of which the North Slope legacy fields are conventional reservoirs, it may take 10 to 15 years before I hit 80% of the production's been recovered. In a shale well, which is where most of your new production is coming from, I hit that 80% mark in somewhere between 12 to 18 months. So that is the very different structure of both investing in and receiving a return of that investment and making profit on the conventional versus the unconventional.
So, Senator Keel.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mr. Ruggiero notes, we're working in a fairly conventional basin.
Okay. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly to start, what I wanted to go over is, as you probably have seen from the presentation that just occurred, this is oil and gas tax is a very dense subject, and it has a lot of pieces to it. And I'm going to do my best to try and make it as clear and simple as I can. But I do understand that after so many years of working with this, there is stuff that is second nature to me that just flies out my mouth. And I will look at the faces to see if there's, you know, confusion, and we'll stop and allow for questions. Because the one thing that I think that you want to do, and in the time that I've been here, is we have always stressed for you to make a good decision, you have to have a good understanding. And you have to have understanding of facts as you move forward. And there's a lot of information that's not. So I just want to put that out there that anytime I'm comfortable with questions, Mr. Chairman, at any time through the presentation. Sure. So what I'm going to kind of go over is I was asked to come in not as a member of industry, but as a member of the producing industry. I've been asked to come in as a member of industry overall and someone who's looked at the different aspects of this and say, how would SB 114 play in the market? And so what you're going to see in here is I don't have any in-depth knowledge, nor do I want it, of the actual tax workings of all the various producers. But I come at this from the general understanding of having worked this and having understood Alaska. And so the comments that I'm making come from that perspective. So what my topic really covers today is talking about the uncharted waters that the fossil fuel industry is heading into. And then the second piece, I think, which really became clear from a lot of the questions, one of the things that tends to happen in these committee rooms is everything gets boiled down to a price. What happens at this price? What happens at that price? Well, if the price goes up $10, if nothing else you should take away from the order of operations, there are seven lines on there other than price that impact the taxes going to be paid, that impacts who gets how much share. And so I think you need to keep that in mind, that anytime you try and boil a discussion here down to price, you're boiling it down the wrong way. You've got to look at the system as a whole. And then the last bit that I'm going to cover in looking at the particular provisions of three key provisions of SB 114 is, does that really provide the right incentives and the right drivers to take Alaska into this business longer term? For all the new faces, yep, I started with ACES. I came here for 3 days, and I had to go to John Myers and buy clothes because they kept me here for 33. So I was here for the entire special session on ACES, and then worked the various pieces that had to do with gas lines and oil gas separation and the rest moving forward. Worked on the LNG. There was a bit of a break in there as our company got bought out, and I went to work for a service company. And then I retired and came back and have worked for the LBA for 6 years between 2016 and 2022, so advising you and your compatriots on any number of oil and gas issues that came before you during that period. But in my career also, I have what I call the three-legged stool. I spent my first 20 years working for Big Oil. My role there was as a project developer. So I was on the new, I started in operations and I went into project development. So I was negotiating with governments the fiscal terms to do projects. Worked for a service company, so I got to see how they get treated when prices are high and prices are low. And the one thing that you learn is, a takeaway I can give you is that when prices rise rapidly, take 6 to 8 months before the service companies are able to raise their price. When prices fall rapidly, I got the phone call an hour ago. Please, doesn't matter what we've signed, we got to lower these prices to try and be profitable. And then the last position is as government advisor. So again, for people who haven't heard this before, the background that comes in here, the governments I've advised at the very, very top level, Saudis for over 6 years, Kuwaitis for 8 years. So major producers, Indonesia, Australia, Brazil, and was part of the growth of East Timor, which was the newest country in the world in 2002, was one of the main authors on their legislation, their regulation, and their contract. So I've had the benefit of seeing the big boys in the Middle East, benefit of emerging nations like East Timor and Trinidad, and in moving forward. So the perspective that you're getting today is you're getting the benefit of all that background in what I'm bringing forward. I kind of put up there, and I tried to count on the legislative side. I think I counted 5 names that were here at ACES. So I joined those 5 people and actually having sat through all this evolution of the Alaska tax. And even though when I turn in my invoice, it's going to be paid by somebody different, in the near future here, my views that you're going to hear today are the views I've been sharing for 17 years. And my views weren't always acted on, but my job was to put them out there. The decision makers make the decisions. And then after those decisions are made, I try and help them mitigate what I believe might be some shortcomings or whatever is chosen at that point in time. I'm sure there will be some that have combed through every one of the multitude of presentations I've given, the words that I've said, and they're going to have the gotcha questions coming at me, but that's okay. I'm comfortable because what I say and what I've done has remained consistent with that throughout that time period. My fourth bullet point there, which is really, really key in the fifth one, we've always talked about, you saw there were drivers for SB 21, but I've worked on 6 potential things since SB 21 to change. I've always asked, what's the driver? Other than the state has a very near-term cash need, what's the driver? Where is your balance between the near-term and the long-term? Because Alaska is not a short-term play state. It's a long-term play. If you're going to attract people to come here, they're coming here for the long-term. They're making a long-term commitment, and they over the long-term, they're going to have to put in some pretty substantial amounts of capital. Again, back to Senator Keel's question, I thought was really good. And what's what's the shape of the curve is the same. So what's different here? In a shale well, I put my money in, I get it out in less than a year, and I go to the next one. So over a 10-year period, I might cycle that same capital 15 times at a 20%+ rate of return, 15 times. Whereas I cycle the same amount of capital here in Alaska once to make a 20% return. So those are the little nuances that don't get picked up all the time. So, the question was asked by Senator Wilson, how does Alaska compare to these other regimes? And we're going to go to one number. We're going to go to a headline rate. Well, Texas has 25% royalty, 4% severance tax, 29%. Alaska's at whatever Alaska's at. But that doesn't tell the story. That doesn't tell you why their money is going into Texas at the rate that it is versus coming to somewhere like Alaska. And so this is what I keep saying. Figure out what your drivers are. Don't focus on single points like price. And look at the package as a whole and how that package is going to help you meet the drivers that you put together as a state. I'm not going to go over this, but I just put in a glossary because there's going to be certain terms you're going to see on slides just to help you reference back if you need be. But on to slide 6, I just want to put a picture because I found that this is helpful, especially to a lot of people that may be watching online. We're going to hear and we're going to talk about a lot of terms, and Dan Stickle always does an excellent job on the order of operations, but he puts it in a table from top to bottom. I'm trying to put it in the graphic. So this all starts on what we call the West Coast. ANSWC is the West Coast price of oil. From that, you then subtract transportation, which is a combination of all those tankers and the TAPS pipeline. And then that'll bring you back to the North Slope, at which your starting point is the GVPP, or the gross value at the point of production. We then subtract our OPEX and CAPEX, and we get what's called the production tax value. And then that's when the DOR works their magic to come up with how much tax you owe. But in case it seems clear, I wanted to have a little fun here, is I put together this for you. So the gross tax percentage that is your minimum tax floor gets set by the ANS West Coast price. However, it's the GVPP that that percentage is applied to in figuring out what that minimum tax is. You use the PTV value to calculate the tax, the preliminary net tax, but I use the GVPP value to determine how many per barrel credits I get to subtract. I then have to compare two different tax calculations, the gross and the net, and for the most part, I pick the greater of. That is unless my field is a GVR eligible field. And then from the GVPP, I can subtract 20 or 30%, apply a flat $5 per barrel credit, and now I can go even below the minimum tax. I can go straight to a zero tax when applying all that. So the simple concept of just backing things up, we have all these different points at which things are determined. So when you change one thing in the system, you have to look at each one of these pieces that can be varied. You know, the DOR, as they do, an excellent job, gave you economic runs assuming a cost and a cost structure. Well, hold cost, but I mean, hold that price for, let's say, as a scenario, but vary your cost by 20% up, 20% down. And you'll find that there are little, what I'm going to call are artifacts, that because the tax system works as a whole and not on a single number, those artifacts start to show themselves. And I would take you back to slide number 19 that Mr. Stickle used. The rest of you saw three curves, minimum tax, current tax, and tax if 114 was passed. I'm a strange techie when it comes to tax. I saw the fact that the new tax had about 6 different slope inflection points. So I'm trying to think what caused those 6 inflection points. And those are the type of questions you all should be asking to make sure, because whatever caused those inflection points, if prices should go up, costs should change, or you want to do something different on the credits, those inflection points will move as well. And you really can't be making informed decisions unless you have a really good, robust understanding of what those numbers are going to do.
Senator Stedman.
Before we go to the next slide, maybe we could tie in the presentation, because a lot of people from home watch, and we have a lot of new members in the country. Try not to use acronyms, even though they're written in the slides, but try to take the time to pronounce them so people can follow. I'm afraid we're going to lose too many people, and if we took a quick test on slide 7, I think most of the building flunked out.
I totally agree.
No disrespect to being able to follow a complex tax structure, but I think there's very few people that would follow it if we don't take the time to actually pronounce all the acronyms.
Senator, I totally agree. So, Mr. Ruggiero, if you'd be mindful of that.
Mr. Chair, as I even told myself in the beginning when I started, is I tend to just, the acronyms flow. So I apologize. I'll keep me honest, and I'll try and keep not using the acronyms, but the full explanation. If I can just get through this kind of last slide of the intro, is I've been doing either negotiating deals or helping governments do deals or looking at tax systems. The reason there's so many people employed working on this is because there is no ideal system. The reason there's no ideal system is every government I've worked with has a unique set of drivers. What they need is different. Some are just growing and trying to develop into a first world country. They may have large domestic needs. Others may be, I've been here, done this a long time, and I'm really big into just exporting everything. So what drives me that way? And each has a different balance to their short, long-term, and how they respond to global competition. I mean, we had one client that we went into once that was just opening up, and we said, here's what you want to do, but here's the learning from the past 12 countries that have gone through this. And the oil minister kind of looked and said, thank you. We're going to start here, and went to sort of the second step in the process, because that's where he felt he had the need to do it. So I want to talk about nothing's ideal. Everything can be done. There are so many moving parts that you can actually design something for any situation. This is why I keep saying you have to say, what is the situation you want to design for? What is it that you're really trying to get to in that balance between long-term and short-term? The industry, and people always said change. Just understand that change, this is my statement I always make here and elsewhere, change is the only constant in the oil business. I've never known a static period. And just go back to looking at the slide that Ms. Moriarty put up there. Was anything looking stable on that chart? No, nothing. There's always constant change. And so, again, I'm sorry, but I'm going to revert back. When you decide fiscal policy on looking at different prices and fixing things to prices, the one thing you know is, A, prices are going to change rapidly. But there are so many other moving parts that it's a little dangerous to just do that. And as I put up here, you're in the common conundrum that every government runs into every time I've consulted. I would like a little bit more now, but I don't want to hurt the future. So how far can I go? And so the science can run the numbers for you, but then it comes into art, because you have to kind of decide based on everything you've heard, how far is too far, but also how far is not far enough, and to make sure that you make a good informed decision.
Okay. Well, we're brief at ease.
Brief at ease. call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Ruggiero, we're almost ready to go back to the onto the floor. And so could you kind of summarize your introduction or do whatever you want to say before we go on to our next phase?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I have sort of summarized the intro. It okay. Now gets into sort of the heart of what I believe this committee needs to be aware of as it makes its decisions on 114.
Okay.
So we get more into now specific information as a part of the overview.
Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and recess into the adjourn to 1:30.